Aloha! Welcome back to Dolphinville Radio. This is your host, Dolphin Us, with you once again. Thanks for joining us. This is Douglas Dolphinus. Welcome to another Dolphinville Radio show. We're entertaining a guest today, Dr. Michael Sala, all the way from Washington, D.C. And he's here in Hawaii, enjoying the beautiful surf, sun, and sand, and the dolphins. He's just coming off of a workshop with Joan Ocean, a seminar that delved deeply into the subject of extraterrestrial contact. In fact, that's why he was here. Joan met him at a conference in Washington, D.C., and they carried on a dialogue for a number of months. Dr. Sala has been teaching at the American University in Washington, D.C. for these past few years, and is a recognized scholar in his field of government and associated with scholarly papers. He has received grants from the Ford Foundation and other reputable places for his work in the field of politics and government, and has addressed very serious subjects about world political issues. That changed when he issued a book, Exopolitics, which sort of blew the lid off of what's going on in Washington, D.C., and how they're dealing with this subject, and how they've dealt with this subject over the past 40 or 50 years in our government. So I'm welcoming the author, Dr. Michael Sala. He's been a pioneer in the development of this exopolitics. And over these last years, he's formed a scholarly study of the political implications of the extraterrestrial presence here on the planet Gaia. He's the author of Exopolitics, Political Implications of the Extraterrestrial Presence. That's a Dandelion Books, published in 2004. So it's a brand new book, and he's been on many radio shows talking about this. The most notable would be Coast to Coast with George Norrie, and you've been on there a couple of times. Welcome, Dr. Michael Sala, to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Douglas, and thanks for that that introduction and going through all that material in my background.
Well, I think people in our audience are going to be interested to see that you're a man from an academic background. You were scholarly in the sense that you have made a very, very in-depth exploration of world politics. And you see that there's conflict here on a global basis. And you've taught in university levels. You've lent your expertise and your brilliance to trying to resolve some of these issues on a global basis. But now you've stepped into another arena, something that is full of conflict, full of controversy, and that's the arena of ETs and extraterrestrial presence here on the planet. What led you to step into this? Was it one event or a series of events that got you involved in it?
Well, really, a series of events. Two particular events really stood out for me. One was the work I had put into the conflict in East Timor. I had been involved in initiatives trying to resolve that, trying to get the different leading figures from the East Timorese and Indonesian communities to meet in different locations on the planet, Washington D.C., Sweden, Australia. So we organized meetings, getting these people together, and basically started a process where there was a dialogue, and we made a lot of progress in terms of getting people to agree to some resolution of the conflict. Unfortunately, what happened was that in 1999, East Timor basically underwent a series of traumatic events associated with a referendum that was quickly decided upon by the then president of Indonesia. And that led to violence. That led to East Timor basically becoming a very violent zone, where there was a lot of expulsion of Timorese, and that personally represented a breakdown or a major setback in terms of what I had been doing with a number of others. And so I grew very disheartened by that process, because I had personally invested up to 5 years on that, And that meant that after 5 years of work promoting peace and dialogue and good relations, we watched all of that basically go up in smoke. And so I was very disheartened and really felt that the work I was doing in peace and conflict resolution really wasn't getting anywhere. I mean, if you could put so many years into one particular project and then watch it just literally fall apart, then you basically kind of look elsewhere for solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did. I started to look elsewhere. And what really got me moving in the direction of ETs was the 2001 Disclosure Project press conference that Stephen Greer organized.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that basically came away after listening to that believing that, well, this was actually a very serious event, that the evidence that was presented was very compelling. And for me as a scholar, I thought that there was enough there to really start a very serious investigation into all of the allegations,
mm-hmm.
and try to understand how all this related to international conflict.
Mm. So you brought your scholarly background and you applied it to this relatively new area that Stephen Greer put his finger on. It's something he had been involved in for the last 10 or 15 years. And so our listeners probably would be familiar with the Stephen Greer Disclosure Project. Joan has talked about it a number of times and has shown it to many of the people in the seminars. And for some of you who haven't heard about this, I would definitely encourage you to check out disclosureproject.org, Dr. Stephen Greer. The Disclosure Project video had a number of very interesting people. And one of them that stood up, we just mentioned his name, just Clifford Stone. And one of the remarkable things that he talked about in there was that they had determined that there was over 50, in fact, he used the 57 varieties of extraterrestrials that are known out there. This is astounding. And it's something that you've used in some of your lectures and on your radio show in Coast to Coast. That was the topic at hand. Can we talk a little, digress a little bit quickly into the 57 varieties of extraterrestrials, and where are they and who are they and where are they coming from?
Sure, I think it's a very important topic. It was something that I noticed had a very firm foundation in the testimony of a number of the whistleblowers. Clifford Stone, he was someone that actually worked on some of the recovery of found ET craft around the world, and so he had first-hand information that there was a cover-up and that the ET ships were being basically relocated back to the US for reverse engineering and studying. So this is someone who knew about the projects, about the ET races, and so he came up with the figure of 57 races. How he came up with that figure, I'm not certain, but it was something that other whistleblowers also referred to. Maybe not precisely 57, but they referred to an extensive number of ET races.
Dozens and dozens.
Exactly. I believe John Lear, who had a background in the CIA, he also referred to somewhere around the 60 mark in terms of ET races.
Hmm.
Bob Dean saw the NATO assessment, and he said that back in 1960, back in 63, that the NATO assessment referred to at least four ET races that, mm-hmm. were intervening on Earth, that were interacting, so there were more presumably out there doing monitoring activities.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a number of testimonies reporting an extensive number of races, and I thought Clifford Stone and those others really did make a very important point.
Yeah. Well, I know that you're a scholarly man, and when you took up this interest in this particular topic, you approached it like anything else. You did a thorough study, you read the available information, and then you started to compile it. But the study of what you call exopolitics, and you can explain what that term means, how does it differ than just typical UFO research?
Sure. Well, I thought it was a very important step to start to develop this concept of exopolitics. I mean, UFO research was basically looking at the phenomenon of UFOs, trying to come up with sufficient evidence to prove that this UFO phenomenon was something very credible, something worthy of study, and something pointing to an extraterrestrial presence. Extraterrestrial hypothesis was associated with that. So it was very much looking at the scientific process of acquiring information, evidence, and scrutinizing evidence, and trying to make sense of that as best as possible. And typically the people that were at the forefront of this field of UFO studies tended to have a scientific background because that was really what was required. So you had physicists, you had biologists, you had astronomers, engineers, so people who, with the kind of skills that could look at the evidence that was provided in terms of photographs, radar, whatever it was, and scrutinize that. Exopolitics, I believe, was necessary because I think when one looked at the evidence, when one looks at the testimonies and the history, what one sees very early on in the piece was that there was a cover-up. And that is a political process, not a scientific process.
Right.
A political process of systematically preventing the evidence from getting out, supporting the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And there's a lot of examples that I could refer to where you can see that there is a cover-up in place. And because of the overwhelming nature of the evidence out there, when one looks at the sheer volume of it, to me it was very clear that the question is not, are ETs here? The question is more, well, you know, what are they doing? How many of them are there? What are their motivations? These are sort of the questions that are necessary. So I thought the term exopolitics was better because it really puts our attention on that. So we're not really looking at the issue of, you know, are they here? I think that that has been very clearly demonstrated to be the case, and now we need to move to these other questions associated with motivation. How many of them are there, and what's the government doing?
Right, that's the next tier of thinking, not, you know, can you prove their existence? There's enough evidence to support that. What were your main sources when you were doing the research for the exopolitics?
Well, what I did was I basically divided different sources of information in terms of the most compelling to the least compelling. And so I started off with things like whistleblowers, people who worked in projects, worked in the military, worked in government agencies, people who had some first-hand knowledge, either in terms of having witnessed ETs themselves, witnessed the ships themselves, the ships being reverse engineered, or saw some of the highly classified documents describing procedures, government procedures for dealing with the ET presence in terms of, well, you know, how do you develop a process for relocating a downed ET ship? What do you do in terms of packaging and sanitizing the area? So those sorts of kind of government documents. And so the most compelling sources I felt were the whistleblowers. I thought that people who worked in the projects, worked as a military intelligence official, for example, or worked as a government contractor for a highly classified project, that when these people came forward and revealed what it was that they were doing, I thought that that was highly compelling because, and in many of these cases, these people's lives were on the line, and some of them actually suffered quite severely for it, and their lives were ended in very suspicious circumstances.
And it's kind of funny the way the media has treated this information. I always ask the question, how much of this is truth? And then they're warping the truth out with, say, making a comedy like Men in Black, which is based on a comic book series, which was based on some comic book writer's notion of things that he was picking up. We know that information is more than just verbal and linear, and that we're absorbing information of consciousness in nonlinear ways. Part of the things that the dolphins and whales have shown us, that these kinds of informational accesses are available to us, and perhaps the parallel between our communication or attempted communication with the species such as cetaceans is in fact a beautiful introduction to the way that we might try to start to interpret the way that we would have you know, communications with other races besides humans. What do you feel is the main reason, the main thrust, why the government wanted to keep this information from the public at large?
Well, I think that they were very much in a debate amongst themselves over what to do of this phenomenon. I think it was so earth-shattering, just the nature of discovering that it wasn't just one ET race visiting, but there were a number of them, and their agendas weren't clear. I think it basically began as really a kind of an instinctive response, which was to just keep it secret until you worked out what to do. And a very logical process for any government agency, especially given the kind of sheer magnitude of this phenomenon, of this event. And I think what happened was that as time went on and they set in place procedures and institutions for dealing with ETs and the cover-up of ETs and studying the ET phenomenon, understanding best how to deal with it, that the question of releasing this to the general public became less and less important to them. They probably felt that the phenomenon was so difficult to handle, that they themselves were having such great difficulty in understanding it, that the public, in their view, were probably not going to do too well in understanding and integrating that material. And I think that that just basically developed over the year, and then it became a bureaucracy unto itself. A kind of, I think the way bureaucratic departments grow is that after a certain time they tend to develop a kind of a survival instinct, and I think the kind of shadow government or the secret committees that run ET affairs develop a kind of consciousness of looking after themselves, believing that they were best suited to deal with all of these questions, that politicians, by nature of it being a very transitory phenomenon, these people often come in for limited terms, 4, 8 years or whatever it is, really weren't up to speed on this, and so they felt that as bureaucrats, as people who worked on this full time over a number of decades, that it was best, that decisions were best left to them, and I think that that has just continued, and we still have secrecy and there's non-disclosure.
As a researcher, how do you go through all of this information and start to discern, okay, this is some rumor mill here, well, how am I supposed to take this seriously if some of the information seems to sound and feel right to me and other parts of it don't? And likewise, the whole body of information that's come out on the ETs, some of it is so fantastic that you go, well, I can't touch the subject with a 10-foot pole. And yet somebody like Stephen Greer comes out with very serious and compelling evidence. So as a researcher, how do you go about, first of all, discerning the information that you're getting, what's real about the information, and where does the disinformation come in? I mean, that seems like it would be a very tricky arena to be playing in.
Oh, definitely it is. I think when we're looking at one individual whistleblower or one source of evidence on a particular ET race, you need to look at such things as, well, how coherent is the person giving this information? How consistent is it with other sources? I think cross-referencing with other sources is very important, because that's where you can really get a sense of, well, just how accurate are things like Prester Nichols and the Montauk experiments. When other whistleblowers start talking about experiments at Montauk, and there's a lot of testimony of people who underwent some of the kind of mind control and the experiments that were held there, then that kind of lends support to some of the other claims that Prester Nichols is making, because it shows that there is stuff happening at Montauk. And credibility, that's a very important thing. I mean, just how credible is the whistleblower? Has this person been interviewed by independent sources? What's the body language like? Does the person, when they're being interviewed, exhibit the signs of someone who's kind of contriving all this, or is it coming across as genuine? And I think when you look at all of these things, you're able to get a sense of whether someone like, say, Preston Nichols or someone like, say, Alex Collier are actually credible in terms of the information they're releasing.
And judging by your body language, you feel that they are.
Yes, I feel pretty confident that when I have looked at the testimonies of these people, that it fits with the big picture that I see kind of unfolding here, and that they're giving little bits of the puzzle, and it fits in with other bits of the puzzle. So I feel pretty confident that many of these whistleblowers are giving a piece of this complex puzzle of the ET presence.
Are you starting to get a picture of the variety of 16 different varieties? Are you the first one who's made this attempt to discern these varieties in this particular way?
Oh, no, definitely not the first. I mean, I think the person who really tried to make an effort in distinguishing different ET races in terms of their motivation, George Andrews did something back in 1987, Extraterrestrial Friends and Foes, that was the title of his book, and he tried to look at those ET races in terms of their activities, their motivations that fell into the category of, say, malevolent, mm-hmm. and those that fell into the category of benevolent. Mm-hmm. And so he tried to distinguish some of these races. I mean, his typology was very limited because I think the data set he had was very small. It was in the days when there was an internet. There really wasn't that much information around.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, given the information he had, he came up with a number of different ET races. I think it was three or four
mm-hmm.
That really were the ones that were doing a lot of the work in terms of interacting with humanity.
And which four were those again?
For him, he focused on the Greys, he focused on the Lyrans, the Procyons, and the Talseti. So there were four races, three falling into the category of benevolent and mm-hmm. one into the category of malevolent.
And he thought the Greys were the malevolent race?
Exactly. And the interesting thing about his typology was that he was able to refer to statements made by extraterrestrials from these other races who narrated what had happened on their worlds vis-a-vis the Greys. That apparently the Greys have a reputation in the galaxy for mm-hmm. visiting human worlds and infiltrating them, mm-hmm. Basically trying to generate support for genetic experiments, infiltrating military intelligence organizations,
mm-hmm.
and being able to exert their influence in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then, at a certain time, exerting much greater influence and having a takeover.
So we're talking about the Greys, and of course, that's, you know, Whitley Strieber had this wonderful series of books that, you know, he was a great fictional writer and...
Well, Whitley Strieber is a very interesting case. I mean, having that background as a horror story writer and then starting to write about Greys and the experiences that he had and others has that he has written about, and writing in terms of this being a very horrific event. And that does kind of raise the eyebrow of people that might be thinking, well, you know, is this something that is just contrived? Or
mm-hmm.
is this something that really is just another form of selling books? I mean, and I think that's unfortunate because he has that background as a horror fiction story writer. So I think that in his case, people can raise that question. Now, as far as Greys and the kind of traumatic events that people undergo when they're abducted by them, I think there are so many other reports chronicling the kind of trauma associated with the Grey abduction
mm-hmm.
that we can safely assume that, well, what Whitley Strieber is talking about is just one mm-hmm. Perspective that he has that is supported by a number of others suggesting that, well, you know, this is not contrived information, it's very consistent with what others are seeing and reporting, and I think that there is an underlying reality there to this idea that there are Greys committing abuses when they are conducting the abductions and the genetic experiments associated with them.
Hmm. Well, we know the media has been manipulated in one more manner or another. We see more and more evidence of it in our present day politics. So how do you, as a researcher or somebody attempting to get a handle on all of this, how do you know what is just being blown up as a piece of media to draw attention and what's the authentic stuff that's coming in?
Mm-hmm. Well, fortunately, as far as the media is concerned, they operate very similarly to what scholars would be doing, which is to look at the evidence, look at the testimonies of people, look at the evidence that's available, and try to deduce what is going on and build a story around that. So in that sense, the media is really not that difficult to understand because they are doing something similar. In terms of how much they just blow things up for sensational purposes as opposed to doing credible reporting, well, I think that some media reporters, for example, I think of Linda Moulton Howe as someone who does a really good job in sticking to the facts and really just presenting the material and building a case that this is a very credible phenomenon. There may be other media sources that tend to play it for its sensational values
mm-hmm.
That you see things like the X-Files. Mm-hmm. There you have a kind of underlay of reality, mm-hmm. and a kind of sensationalizing, fictionalizing of things. So one can see that there is some creativity happening here. Mm-hmm. So,
well, there's different kinds of evidence that you say, okay, I don't want to use this as evidence or as a source. And if there is that kind of stuff, is that what makes the determination for you?
Well, looking at someone's testimony or someone's evidence that they provide, I think, for example, Dan Burrish is an interesting example. This is someone who claims to have worked up until recently on a covert project involving the development of a genetically inspired organism that was gained through collaboration with an ET by the name of J-Rod that was part of a covert program that was based out at Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question is, well, how do you determine whether his testimony is valid or not? George Noory, for example, his approach was to say, well, if Dan Burrish submits to a lie detector test, well, that would tend to support his credibility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if Dan Burrish decides not to do that, well, what does that mean? Does mm-hmm. that mean that he's contriving it, or are there other valid reasons for him not submitting to that? So I think that's the sort of issue that that the media has to deal with, and scholars have to deal with. How do you deal with the kind of more difficult cases of people having these really fantastic stories and alluding to their role in them and giving you some evidence and there's credibility for what they're saying, then how far do you go in supporting that? It's a tough one, but I think this is something we have to deal with.
Hmm. Well, we're going to take a little short break here and get the listeners a chance to digest some of what we talked about. When we come back, I would like to talk some more about the whistleblowers, the people who have really instigated waves of information that has caused us reason to think about what's going on out there. And then we'll explore some of the other things that have happened to you and try to tie it in with some of the experiences that you've had more recently here in the ocean and the what we like to call the extraterrestrial cetacean race that you're on the planet. So we'll be back in just a few short minutes after this interview. Okay, I wanted to share this album that just came in with everybody in the audience listening. It's an album from Byron Bay, Australia, Dr. Didge, and it's Dolphinism with the Dolphin Tribe out of Australia. It's good to listen to.
Dolphin eyes beaming. Pure fluid consciousness.
Reaching out, positive vibrations reaching in to your heart, to your mind, to your spirit, to your soul.
Dolphin dreams. dolphins in the desert of human understanding. We're dolphins alive, swimming in the ocean.
Doing joy, doing great, catching waves, dynamic waves. Fear, steal us. Don't cage us. Do not destroy us. For we are you whom you have forgotten.
We are masters of the sea. Playfully. Free. Humans, learn to not create your own suffering. To not create ours.
Okay, we're back talking with Dr. Michael Saw. His new book is Exopolitics. It's dealing with how the U.S. government in particular has been working with the extraterrestrial race and how they've dealt with the public and keeping us from information. Now, one of the speakers over the last 10 or 20 years on this field, Robert Dean, is pretty well known. Were you able to interview him personally? He was one of the main guys in your book, along with Clifford Stone, isn't that correct?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I have interviewed him personally and mm-hmm. also read all of his material. Mm-hmm. And I like to use him for the reason that he has a lot of credibility in terms of his background. Mm-hmm. He served mm-hmm. in the military for 27 years,
right.
Reached some very important positions in there, including being on the briefing team for the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe
mm-hmm.
Back in the early 1960s. Which is when he claims that he came across the documents describing the ET presence and what NATO had put in place to deal with that presence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought he was a very interesting person in terms of his history, but also because of his credibility, that someone who serves for that long in the military, I think, gets people's attention,
mm-hmm.
especially when they hear him and see that he's quite lucid, coherent,
mm-hmm.
and that there's a lot of integrity to some of the things that he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought he was a very interesting case
mm-hmm.
Because it does really get people to take note that, well, there's something happening here, and he is amongst a very exclusive number of ex-military, intelligence, government employees that
mm-hmm.
are coming forward and
right.
taking risks in releasing this information.
One wonders if that's a reality as well, and do you fear your own life for stepping into this arena?
Well, I think in the case of Robert Dean and some of the other whistleblowers, what they've learned because of their long association with the military and the intelligence communities is to basically stay within an acceptable boundary in terms
mm-hmm.
of releasing information, that they understand that they're taking a risk by coming forward, but they also know that if they don't go too far,
mm-hmm.
that there's a certain amount of flexibility that they have, that they'll
mm-hmm.
be given a certain amount of rope to be able to kind of like reveal what's going on, but not that much that they basically end up hanging themselves, and they're aware of that. And I think having spoken to Bob Dean personally, he made it clear that this was something that he was very concerned about, that he had to basically play by the rules. There was a lot that he had, a lot of information that he had that he wanted to release, but he had to play by the rules, that there were certain things that he just couldn't talk about, but there were other things that he could talk about, and so he would just release, discuss what he could, and that way get as much information out as he could. In the case of certain people being targeted, I think definitely that happens. There was the case of Stephen Greer contracting cancer. I think one of his closest workers, Shari Adamea, also contracted cancer and died from that. There was also the congressman from New Mexico, Stephen Schiff, who contracted cancer and died from that. And I do believe, based on the testimonies that I've seen, that there is a certain technology that is available where they can induce these types of illnesses in people.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of psychotronic technology that has been used. And so that's certainly something that any researcher needs to keep in mind. And in my own case, I think I kind of really went for what I felt was true, not thinking about the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And as And in cases like this where, you know, there are potential consequences, well, I think there have already been consequences that I've paid in terms of like a career, finances, because one really does make sacrifices in those areas. And so then when it comes to the issue of life, then it just becomes, well, you know, if you sacrifice your career and your financial kind of base is eroded for nothing, and then the kind of life-threatening possibilities aren't as intimidating as they were once before.
How and what kind of evidence did you, have you found and discovered for 57 different ET races? What's out there that we can hang our hat on?
Well, there's different categories of evidence. I mean, I've already spoken about the whistleblowers. I think the contactees, I mean, these are people who claim to have actually been visited by ET races, claims to have been taken up on the ships by the different ETs. Now, some of these have actually given photographs of the ships and of the ETs. They have independent witnesses of what they saw. So they give some very credible evidence that they underwent this contact process, and it was a very physical event, and that they have knowledge to share. And I've found those accounts to be very significant. They give a lot of information about various ET races, their motivations, the activities that they do. And what's also interesting that I found in my research is that these contactees experience some very heavy treatment from the government. Typically what happens is that they're visited by those within the military intelligence community who want to know, well, what happened, what did the ETs tell you, what did they give you, what are the kind of ships that you were visited by, and so they really do get attention, and I think that there's a lot of evidence that the military intelligence community are very closely monitoring the contactees and intimidating them into silence. And I have found that in the case of a few contactees that I've interviewed, that there has been intimidation, that there has been they have been silenced because of threats to their family, to their friends, if they come out talking about human-looking ETs taking them up into ships and introducing them to other worlds.
Do you see it going to a point where this disclosure will come about, where we can finally drop the veils of secrecy and start to appreciate 57 different species of extraterrestrials who happen to be living and working here? And do you see that's where we're going with this? Where are we going with this, and where do you see this coming out?
Well, I think disclosure is inevitable. There's going to be some public announcement of an ET presence at some point, and I think that is basically inevitable because of the nature of the internet, the way information is now circulated. So many people are circulating information. In my own case, I've circulated all my information through the internet. The book was published early this year, but that hasn't got nearly as much exposure as the internet material. And I think the internet really is the big equalizer here, because it is so quick, it is so difficult to repress, and the information, once it gets out there, it really does have an impact. So the internet is something that really has guaranteed in my mind that disclosure is inevitable. I think the big question mark is how is disclosure going to be spun?
Right.
I think it's really a question of how the military intelligence and the shadow government are going to put their spin on the information that's available out there. And that, for me, is really the interesting question here, because they know that disclosure is inevitable. The question is, how are they going to spin it so that they continue to maintain the secret infrastructure that they've built without compromising it, and without, for example, making it something that's going to be under congressional oversight, which would be their worst fear, that these part-time politicians somehow make decisions concerning ET.
Well, if we've been in contact for these 40 or 50 years, and now you've focused your attention on 16 varieties of ETs, others have named 57 varieties, even more numbers have come in, what are they doing here? How do you explain that? If they're already here, why aren't they doing something to help the situation a little bit more?
Well, it's a very important question, and the way I went about answering that was that I developed a framework for looking at the 16 races that I thought were most significant in terms of their interactions with humanity. While there is evidence of many more races, it was these 16 races that repeatedly came across in the literature, in the various testimonies, as the ones that were most significant in terms of interacting with humanity and having an effect here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I did in terms of differentiating these races is rather than differentiate on the basis of moral qualities,
mm-hmm.
which is always a very difficult thing to do,
mm-hmm.
you know, benevolent versus malevolent,
right.
What I did was I basically said, well, which ones have shown evidence of cooperating with the government, and which ones have stayed outside of these cooperative agreements? Because I think one of the things that does become clear in the evidence is that at a very early stage, the government actually established communications with some ET races.
The Eisenhower papers that you brought to people's attention, I noticed too, which, you know, I'd like to hear more about that too, but go ahead.
Exactly, yes. The Eisenhower paper, that referred to a February 20 meeting in 1954 where President Eisenhower met with some ET races, and that was the first of a series of meetings leading to agreements, that there have been agreements reached between ET races and the US government, in particular the shadow government or the committees that make decisions concerning ET affairs. And these have led to a variety of joint projects, underground bases, sharing of technology, also in terms of working with civilians who are unaware of the ET presence and of the government collaboration on that. So there are a number of ET races that are part of these agreements, and I, in the document, list those different ET races, different categories of greys, different categories of reptilians, and also some other races that are involved in those agreements. And then I look at the other ET races who, in most of the literature, described as benevolent, who basically stayed outside of these agreements. I mean, they thought that basically the military intelligence community were only interested in developing weapons, using ET technology for building their military arsenals, and so they wanted to stay out of the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically that was how I distinguished them. You know, those that are inside of the kind of military industrial extraterrestrial complex,
mm-hmm.
and those that are outside of it.
The MIEC, Mike.
Exactly.
We started to talk about what happened in 1954, in November, when President Eisenhower supposedly went away for a dental exam, only we learned that it wasn't a dental, emergency dental exam from Palm Springs. He went someplace else. What do you know about that meeting, and what do you think took place?
Well, that's a very interesting event because it occurred at a time where the U.S. was developing its thermonuclear capacity, and the very first hydrogen, or the last ever hydrogen bomb test was planned for March 1st of 1954. So about 10 days earlier, you have this meeting that occurs, and there are a number of whistleblowers, people who had some evidence that, in fact, there had been a meeting with President Eisenhower and some extraterrestrials to discuss America basically giving up its nuclear testing program, and in return the ETs would help with the US dealing with a number of issues before it would be able to kind of like announce the ET presence. So there was a meeting, and this meeting was described in terms of the effect it had on those who participated. Apparently there was a delegation of private citizens involving some very prominent individuals, very senior, past retirement, like for example Cardinal McIntyre from the Catholic Church. There was also someone who was representing the Hearst newspapers, a retired reporter, Franklin Allen, and there was also a retired economist who was previously on President Truman's Economic Advisory Board, Edwin North. So you had these senior retired people who were there to witness the ET phenomenon and determine whether the public was ready for this news. So apparently the way it was described by a number of different sources, ETs landed, there was a meeting, there was communication, there was a great debate apparently between various policy advisors, the military, intelligence community that were present. Apparently there was a very intense debate over what to do in terms of releasing this to the general public. And I think one of the other aspects of the meeting was that a decision was made as to whether or not there would be an agreement reached with this particular ET race, and that concerned the testing of the nuclear weapons. And because the nuclear tests did go ahead, the Bravo test on March 1st, 1954, that was 15 megaton capacity. That was the biggest ever hydrogen bomb test by the US. It was vast, it was on the Bikini Atolls. What that signaled was that America was committed to thermonuclear weapons, and that the ET race that participated in that meeting was basically repudiated. And I think what happened subsequent to that was that other ET races came online, had meetings, and agreements were reached where there was technology sharing.
So there was only one race that you know of and present at that particular meeting, or was there more than one race represented?
Based on what I've been able to gain from other sources, and these aren't conclusive, is that the races present were Nordic races. That very first meeting, they were Nordic, and that in particular they came from the star systems of Tau Ceti and Epsilon Eridani. That was the information that I was able to gain from other sources. But clearly the whistleblowers pointed to a Nordic presence, that these are Nordic ETs that were present at that very first meeting.
Well, the Nordics, also associated with the Aryan race, seem to be associated also with Nazi Germany. Have you heard any rumors circulating about Hitler's connection to the ET races, particularly the Aryans?
Well, definitely, yes. I think Nazi Germany was very interesting because it is clearly based on the evidence. The very first case of a major world government having relations with a variety of ET races, and also with what were described as an inner Earth race, a race of beings that presumably were very Nordic looking, a very pure, genetically kind of Nordic race that became a model for Hitler's Aryan program. Now, it also looked as though there was communication between Nazi Germany and this particular group of races, inner Earth and also off-world. In particular, the Pleiadians were remarked to be one of those races that Nazi Germany had communicated with. And it appears that whatever it was that Nazi Germany gained through these communications helped them modernize their military sufficiently that they were almost able to win the Second World War.
And now we have 57 more varieties or more species that are adding themselves to the mix. This sounds like it might be just overwhelming for the poor little human mind to comprehend. And you have a discussion group that you've been conducting for some time now, and that stimulated a lot of this information to come out. Do you find that you think that this is the avenues that we're going to be able to start to grow this new informational highways?
Oh, definitely. I do believe that if you give people the information and that you find the best information and you find as much clarity as you can and try to discuss that in a very open and kind of non-manipulative way, that eventually people start to figure it out for themselves. I mean, I certainly think that my job as an academic, as an educator, is really not to kind of answer questions for people, but to help them ask the right questions. You know, really, that's my job. And I get great delight in seeing people ask the right questions. And, I mean, it's always nice if they answer in a way that kind of fits with your preferences, and that's always kind of nice ego thing. But I think, personally, if I see people asking the right questions and going beyond what I've developed, then that's fine. I think that is really where we need to go. And that's what I think the web is doing, and I think that's the discussion forum that I've created and continue to moderate the Prepare for Contact group. We've got over 700 members now, And that really is a very thriving little community, asking a lot of questions, there's debates, and we're moving forward. We're sharing the information, we're sharing the experiences, and so from this kind of pool of shared information, experiences, we're moving towards some position that I'm certainly not sure of myself, because I just bring a certain piece to this puzzle.
Well, how would our listeners access this discussion group?
Well, it's a Yahoo discussion group. It's basically the easiest way to do it is to just go to the web page exopolitics.org, mm-hmm. and there they'll see the link to the discussion group and to the mailing list I have for exopolitics, and they can just click those links, and that'll take them directly to the discussion group, and they can enroll online, and they can then read all the information in the posts, and there's a lot of good information there.
I bet there is. Because as I say, I know that your approach is to be scholarly about this, and you're already acting as a great filter, and getting rid of a lot of nonsensical things that may occur with this. Let's turn our conversation into what you feel that these extraterrestrial races are here to give us, and what are they doing to assist humanity in this step into our galactic citizenship.
Well, that's really a great question. I think there are two categories of ETs in terms of their overall approach. One are those that are willing to work with the government, and there are those that don't want to work with the government. And the ones that are willing to work with the government, they participate in these agreements. They might be technology sharing, it might be working to build joint facilities for research, working together to pioneer new understandings, genetic experiments involving humans. And I think that in this collaboration that there's a certain learning that goes on. There's a learning curve for the government, who are naturally suspicious, I think, of ETs in general.
Mm-hmm.
And so even more so of ETs that they reach agreements with.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this very funny situation where you have government reaching agreements with ETs that they don't really trust,
mm-hmm.
but knowing that, well, through these agreements they're going to get access to technologies that they wouldn't otherwise get.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this very interesting dynamic happening here. And I think in that dynamic, in that kind of arena of mistrust and suspicion and kind of low intensity conflict in different parts of the planet, where you get occasions of ET ships being shot down by technologies that the government has developed as a result of collaborating with ET.
Mm-hmm.
What we see is that there's a learning curve happening here, that the government is learning that while reaching agreements with ETs to get their technologies, while they work with our citizens in terms of genetic experiments, maybe that wasn't such a good idea after all.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we should think about working with these other ETs who really weren't wanting to give us technology at all,
mm-hmm.
but really saying that while there was some kind of spiritual or moral development that needed to be worked on first, that maybe we have something to learn from them. So I think what we're seeing here is that the government is embroiled in these agreements, finding that they're not getting as much out of it as they can, as they hope that they could, and they're kind of gravitating towards another path. And then you have private citizens who are interacting with ETs that are outside of the military industrial extraterrestrial complex,
mm-hmm.
and who really who are demonstrating a very high moral integrity, wanting to kind of help people evolving consciousness, develop certain abilities of their own, and doing it through some natural process as opposed to the genetic path. It seems that in terms of the ET races, it appears that there are those ET races that really do embrace the genetic evolutionary strand, that they think that evolution happens by tinkering with genetics and bringing certain abilities online through genetic manipulation. And then you have other ET races that believe that it's kind of through some kind of spiritual evolution and consciousness raising.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that seems to be a fairly accurate kind of distinction here,
mm-hmm.
of ET races. So I think a lot of private citizens are working in very nebulous ways,
mm-hmm.
Maybe unknown to them, with ET groups who are, mm-hmm. involved in this kind of consciousness raising work.
Hmm. Are there ETs amongst us who are able to change their body type so that they look humanoid when in fact they aren't?
Well, that's a very interesting question. According to a number of testimonies, there are greys and reptilians who have this ability to shapeshift, who have some kind of technological ability and or some mind control ability, mm-hmm. where people think that they're seeing a human, but in fact it's a reptilian or a grey mm-hmm. there. But because of this strong psychic mental ability of the greys and the reptilians, and with some possible technological assistance, they're able to imprint on the human mind, mm-hmm. and it may be more than one human, it may be a group of humans, able to imprint on their mind, or on the group mind, that what in fact they're seeing is a human, when in fact it may be an ET from a different species.
Hmm. A couple of years ago, Courtney Brown came out with a book that reviewed the idea of remote viewing. Remote viewing was used by the government as a form of espionage, and it tuned into another dimensional way of looking at things where time and space was not a factor. One of the topics that came up in his book, and apparently one of the reasons why the government sort of shied away from using remote viewing, at least according to his claim, is that they kept running into extraterrestrial races while they were in these states, these altered states, and they were tuning in to what looked like another dimension of being that was simultaneously existing to our own, perhaps at a slightly different wave frequency, so that, you know, as we know, it's mostly space here anyway, and it would seem logical on some quantum level anyway that we could have multiple levels, multiple dimensions existing in the same space and time, only we're not able to see them readily. But now suddenly we've opened up a window to this remote viewing technique that gazes in at races of beings that are going about their business here doing stuff. Do you know anything about that? Have you had any experience yourself with people who sort of tripped in to the remote viewing dimensions?
Well, I think the remote viewing is actually a very important development. It was something that was based on what the Russians did in response to the ETs. I think the Russians chose kind of psychic research as opposed to technological, which seemed to be much more the US response to the ET presence. And I think in response to the kind of progress that the Russians made as far as using psychics for things such as remote viewing, intelligence gathering, that you had a remote viewing program set up in the US, and Courtney Brown was someone who came out of that tradition and started to remote view different ET races. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the information that he was able to extract and published in his two books, Cosmic Voyagers and Cosmic Explorers, was very credible in my mind. It was very consistent with a lot of the other information that I was able to gather, and did a very good job in differentiating different ET races, their motivations, the structures of their societies, mm-hmm. and how they're viewing the Earth, and of course the kind of higher dimensional aspect to this as well. And I don't believe that remote viewing was ever cut off from the military intelligence community. I think what happened was that they basically relocated it from Stanford Research Institute. They basically decided, well, that was too prominent now and having too much exposure. They relocated it and they developed corporate entities where remote viewing was housed, and where they continued to employ numerous psychics in these intelligence gatherings, because really it continues to be the best mode of gathering information on ETs. I mean, how else are you going to find out what ETs are up to other than sending a remote viewer up there who can scan their locations, their whereabouts, and what they're up to?
My own experience is I seem to have had things in the dream time where I'll wake up and it will have been just slightly more than a lucid dream experience, where I'll go, well, wait a minute, something just happened, or I was someplace, or I was in communication on some level that was not here in my bed. And I'm wondering if this is not, again, a gateway experience to the next level of where a consciousness needs to go. And the ETs are there as representatives. And the 57 varieties, or the 62 varieties, or the 16 varieties are merely reflections of our own variety selves.
Yes, definitely. I agree with that. I think that what the ET phenomenon does is it shifts us out of relying on the traditional sources of information get through the five senses, and then it takes us into this other realm where there are these six senses. I mean, whether it's telepathic communication, whether it's some kind of clairvoyant seeing or soft eye seeing of ET ships or ET beings, or some kind of empathic awareness of energies around you, that suddenly we have a phenomenon that results in these types of sixth sense kind of information sources coming online. And some people are very strong in that, and they are able to see things that give an explanation for other things happening around us, and it's very consistent with the ET phenomenon, where we know that ETs have this capacity to somehow shift from this reality matrix, our 3D matrix, into another reality where they disappear, but yet they're still there. But it's just as though they've stepped up their vibration. So I do believe that the sort of thing that Joan is witnessing through her soft eyes is something to really be looked at and taken seriously.
Well, you were here and you were helping and co-facilitating with John these last 2 weeks in an ET Contact seminar. Have you had that kind of experience before, and how did this feel to you to come up here?
Well, it was a real eye-opening and unique experience for me. I think it's helped me move a little from the purely scholarly approach, where I look at the evidence and look at the testimonies of others, to where I was now privileged to start to have some experiences myself. And that was very interesting for me to kind of like make that transition of being the kind of analyst, the interpreter of what others were seeing and experiencing, to one where I was experiencing things, where I could feel certain things and visualize certain things. And it was kind of like moving into that realm where I was getting information through this kind of sixth sense avenue, and was able to contribute to a larger group process where there were many others having similar things happening, and we were able to confirm the experiences and the feelings and the visions that others were seeing, to kind of build confidence that while in fact there was a contact occurring up there involving a number of different races, and this contact was very real and becoming stronger and becoming more established, and certainly Jones Ranch, Sky Ranch up there is a place that has been chosen for this type of work.
Well, she found it with Jean-Luc, and the two of them have been on the trail for a long time. It, as you were talking, it reminded me of the scholarly attempt that Carlos Castaneda made as an anthropologist back in the 60s when he went down to do research on the Yaqui Indian sorcerer, Juan Matus. And it started out, you know, he was reporting his field reports, and he was doing a very anthropological study, and then gradually over the series of books, and his experience went from that of somebody observing to a participant, and then his whole world was engulfed by this new way of thinking and being. And there's a lot of parallels between what you just described and somebody being initiated into the shamanic traditions. Do you find that there might be a parallel between starting to open up to other dimensional beings, ultra-dimensional beings, extraterrestrial beings, nature spirits, angelic realms, and the devic realms? Do you find that they're maybe all part of the same spectrum of awareness that we are trying to open up to?
I think there is something to this whole idea of a kind of tiered layers of reality, and that as we start to develop certain abilities and start to become aware of things such as ETs, then all of a sudden these abilities start giving us information on other beings, whether it's nature spirits, devas, or celestials, angels, and so forth. And it's like, well, you're getting now information about a much more complex and larger reality than you first thought. And even the ET reality, even that becomes limited, even though it is an incredible expansion of our limited 3D reality. When we contemplate the different ET races and their agendas and where they come from, when we engage with that ET kind of reality matrix, then we see that these other reality matrices kind of are even larger. And so it becomes quite challenging to understand it all.
kind of Earth is really a dimensional way station for an intersection of all these planes of existence. And we're unique in that we can support these multiple dimensional levels and sort of like have this one portal where they can all exist simultaneously. However, it's not in a rigid way, because it has to be soft, it has to be very flexible, almost liquid in content, in order for it to support and be flexible enough to support the nature of this other alternative realities or multiple realities as we're seeing. At least that's my interpretation of it. I've been fascinated with, you know, those kinds of realms all of my life, and I was naturally led here to be with the dolphins over a series of events, and the dolphins themselves seem to be a beautiful representation in the physical way of an extrasensory, extraterrestrial, vastly intelligent and extraordinary race of beings who are entirely different than humans, but yet there is a way that we can connect that bridge. And they're here again after many, many thousands of years of being out of our consciousness. They've returned because we're ready to start dealing with what kinds of information. And it may be because the planet is in desperate need of us coming together as a consciousness, or maybe that again we are reaching the point of maturation as a race of beings where we can start to think of ourselves as a planetary consciousness again. That's my hit. That was already in place, and that the remnants of Gaia consciousness, as it's been called, is still very much there. It's sort of like the old energy matrix is just laying dormant. There was a science fiction movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger goes to Mars to re-engage ancient machinery that will put an atmosphere back on the planet. And to me, it was a metaphor for the same kind of energy grid work that has existed on this planet. Some people believe it's supported by a series of pyramids underwater and above. That was an ancient system, an energy ley line grid that supported a sphere of energy around this planet. What its function was to sustain a higher frequency of consciousness and awareness so that we could indeed manifest instantly anything on the physical plane we wanted. So that's the Garden of Eden. That's the stories of the ancient times, that we fell from grace through whatever means, and we're trying to get our way back to it, get ourselves back to the garden. And that's the mythology of my generation and our generation, trying to get back to the garden.
Fascinating. I think that of the experiences that I think are most valued in coming to Hawaii, that dolphin connection really is the most gratifying. It certainly has made a big impact on me, because I think in terms of, you know, how does one prepare others for this ET reality, and I think that dolphins play this incredible role of being a bridge, because one does get the sense swimming with them that, you know, there is an extraterrestrial dimension here to them. That, you know, whether they themselves are somehow space travellers, as some say, able to kind of activate a Merkaba and travel to other realities and other planes of existence. But one does get a sense that this is a non-human energy that has incredible intelligence, incredible love and gentleness, and teaches and also preparing one for another reality. And I think that is certainly something that I want to integrate into my work in helping people to not only prepare for ET contact, but also understand how to deal with different ET races. Contact is happening all the time. I think there's a lot of skills that people need to develop in terms of being able to differentiate between different races and make good choices, because mm-hmm. ultimately all of us are going to be that individual that have the experience that J.D. Foster had with the Contact movie that you mentioned mm-hmm. earlier. We're all going to be facing ET one-on-one, and we're either going to know how to make the right decisions or we're not. And I think that's really what I would like to do, mm-hmm. help people make the right choices. And that means giving them the right experiences, like working with dolphins, mm-hmm. but also the right kind of conceptual frameworks, such as understanding different ET races.
I think it does soften our approach, and the dolphin experience for me and the people that we've shared it with, I've been able to witness just marvelous transformations that it helps people go through. And there's various ways of describing that. We've gone into depth on many of the shows with Joan and others to describe the energy transformations that people have, and whether we can identify it as the source, a sonic source, or the sonic vibrational things that change molecular spins as a result of being in the water surrounded by dolphins. I guess it's not really important, the mechanics of it, but just the effects are very important. And it leads us up to maybe softening ourselves so that we can become contactees. And I know contactees are very important in your research. One of the most famous contactee cases that comes to my mind, in fact, he was written off because his evidence was too pure, was Billy Myers. Were you able to interview him? And you certainly looked at the evidence, and he became one of the sources for your book. Is that correct?
Well, definitely. I looked at his evidence. I haven't been able to interview him personally yet.
Mm-hmm.
But the evidence that he had and that others had investigated was just so compelling in terms of the quality of the photographs, the accuracy of the witness testimonies, and also the thoroughness of the investigators. Wendell Stevens launched a series of investigations and was able to really find that Billy Myers did experience what he claimed to experience, that the evidence he provided was rock solid, that there was no evidence of forgery. And I think that contactees like Billy Myers really are very important, because they are, in a way, the initial contacts for all humanity with ET races, and they're sharing this information, and so we need to treat it with a lot of seriousness.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, because of the efforts of the military intelligence community, many of these people like Billy Meyer and others, other contactees like Alex Collier, who I think is very significant, they're discredited or threatened, and so their information is
continues to be suppressed. What are the positive signs that we can look at that you found that we can say, okay, here is something that the ET is definitely, like, you know, Joan will point to the internet or microchip technology as something that was a piece of technology that was given by the ETs that she understood. Do you have evidence such as that you can share with us?
Sure. Well, Philip Corso was one of those whistleblowers that worked with the military, and in his case he was for a short period head of the Foreign Technology Desk for the US Army, and he claimed that what he in fact did as a result of his time there was to filter through to various corporations some of these technologies such as the microchip, fiber optic cables, some of the textiles that are used in, say, like body armor, Kevlar fibers. I can't quite remember the exact term for it, but
mm-hmm.
basically a lot of these technologies were filtered through, and I think that is happening. There's technologies that were acquired through ETs that are slowly making their way into the market, into the mass market, but I mean, it hasn't really transformed our lives as we would have thought. I mean, we can say that the microchip has through the internet. I mean, it really has transformed our lives. But compared to the potential transformation of the ET presence, it's really just a very small part of how the ET presence is world transforming.
Mm. Well, it's occurred to me in my life that the significant change that takes place in anyone's life are the ones that where we've arrived at the decisions ourselves, where we have gone through a process of elimination, or we've experienced something where we've grown in our wisdom and made a determination based on that experience. So I can understand the argument that the ETs can't just come down and give us a better world, because it won't mean anything to us. We'll go ahead and trash that better world just as readily as the world we're trashing right now. So it's important that this whole process takes place. It can only take place on an individual basis. We have to reconcile our own demons. We have to relinquish our own prejudices. We have to be able to get in touch with our own heart spaces and forgive ourselves and our immediate surroundings before we can even dream about stepping into galactic citizenship.
Yes, I think that's right. I think that it really is a matter of us making the right choices, being informed, and not relying on others to come in and save us. Mm-hmm. That whatever ETs have that they have to share, I mean, is something that can enrich us and help us to step into our power so that we make the right choices. Because ultimately, it really is a kind of horizontal relationship that determines the reality of our world. That even though there's a vertical relationship happening, whether it's ETs or high celestial beings, that whatever information or insights or wisdom that come from there, mm-hmm. ultimately it's the decisions that we make as humans with different nations and different communities, and how we resolve these issues that we have amongst ourselves, that's going to play a vital role in how much of this kind of information we get from ETs or other sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been fascinating. I appreciate your coming in and giving me the time and sharing this information. I really believe it's important. And I'm excited to follow where this is going to lead you, because obviously your path is starting to take on some new strides. Some of the experiences you've had here may lead you into some new things. Let's take one little final break real quick. We'll come back and wrap this up and maybe answer some of those questions on what you see is going to be unfolding for you. I know you have some plans, and be anxious to hear about that. So we'll be back in just a few minutes here. This is a reminder that this show is being brought to you by Photon.net. Photon.net is a full-service provider, and they will meet all your needs. They've been very generous in giving us this broadband for our broadcast today. Let's take a little breather and listen to the music from Andrew Forrest's album Alpha Omega, as it's called Parallel Worlds. Album Alpha Omega by Andrew Forrest. This is available on the Dolphinville gift store. I hope you enjoyed listening to this, and now back to our program on dolphinville.com radio. Okay, we're back for the last part of this show. It's been really interesting talking with Dr. Michael Sala here, author of Exopolitics, dealing with the extraterrestrial phenomenon and how it has integrated itself into our cultural matrix through the government. There are many, many developing fronts of information. The internet is perhaps the most exciting avenue for sharing information. But where are we going with this? Where is consciousness taking this? One of the interesting things that happened during the two-week seminar was that there was an independent movie playing at one of the local theaters, the Art House, that was called What the Bleep Do We Know? Yeah, I was quite fascinated to see a movie of this nature hitting the mainstream. Even though it was in the Art House, it very briefly dealt with such topics as quantum physics, neurophysiology, spirituality, theology, and the 14 or so scientists acted, as they said in the write-up, like a Greek chorus to try to give a backdrop to the docudrama that they were trying to portray of a woman going through a catharsis in her life and how she was trying to resolve whether she had control of her life or her life had control of her. These are interesting questions, and these are interesting times for these questions to come up. What was your reaction to the movie?
I thought it was a wonderful movie and really did push what I think is a revolutionary idea, that is, consciousness influences reality. And I think that idea is something that will continue to gain strength as people validate that observation by a variety of experiments. One of the people that was featured on the in the movie was Dr. Masaru Emoto with his work on water and how consciousness influences water, how just by a simple act of showing love to some water, you can change the configuration of the water molecule. Mm-hmm. And so indicating that consciousness does influence reality, and I think that's a really important insight. And I think it also helps explain what it is that may be happening if we ever want to work with ETs who seem to work with different realities and are able to move between realities, that our consciousness may play a role in that.
Mm. So, I was happy to see that movie, and it was fun that the group went collectively, because I'm sure it made some interesting discussions around the dinner table.
Yes, it really did help bring into focus this whole idea that, well, through our consciousness, we can influence reality, and if we were wanting to have contact with ET races, that consciousness would somehow open up that possibility, would create that opportunity for the ET races to come in. And that's mm-hmm. what many of us experienced there, that in some way, whether it was through some empathic or telepathic or some clairvoyant ability, mm-hmm. people made contact at Jones' event. And, mm-hmm. and that was very significant.
Well, you're helping people do this in various ways. Certainly the books, the television or the radio shows that you've been doing, getting information out. You have online courses, is that correct? How do those work?
Well, basically, yes. I started to do those online courses earlier in the year, and people can just enroll, and it's a 14-week course, mm-hmm. and it runs very much as a traditional course where we go through thematically various topics associated with exopolitics. So the first course, the gatekeeper course, is Introduction to Exopolitics. Mm-hmm. And so in 14 weeks, we go sequentially through what it is that people need to know to better able to deal with the questions of exopolitics. So they're introduced to the primary sources of material. And it involves a lot of reading. It involves some discussion on a forum that is created for that purpose. And so it's a way for people to just come up to speed in a very short time with exopolitics. And I think it's something that shortly, I believe, is going to be very important for many people to mm-hmm. understand as much as they can about the ET presence, mm-hmm. Because they're going to have to make choices in their lives, and you want to make the right choice. And so mm-hmm. you need good information, and you don't want it spun. And that's why I think what I do is give information that isn't spun.
Mm, that's very important.
It basically begins as would a traditional course at one time. So I have a fall course, a summer course, and a winter course or spring course, and so people begin at the same time as a collective, mm-hmm. and that way we share information as a group, and so there is a kind of group sharing,
and each course of study takes a certain, each module has a certain time frame, And then you move on to the next thing. And there's 14 of these levels, you're saying?
Well, each course has 14 weeks.
Weeks
per course. And so far there are two courses. Introduction to Exopolitics, and the second course is Global Management of Extraterrestrial Affairs. And there'll be a third course that I'll be offering not this semester, but in the spring of 2005, and that'll be on galactic diplomacy.
In your research, there's the government that we've identified in exopolitics, the military-industrial extraterrestrial complex. Do you find that there are citizen groups or smaller pockets such as Joan who are conducting their own kinds of study and research that is parallel to, and they're getting their own results? Have you found other groups like that?
Definitely there are. I know that James Gilliland up in Washington State, in the Mount Adams area, is doing this, precisely that, trying to organize some contact events that would bring in a number of people who have an ongoing interest in that. So he's definitely trying to do something up like that up there at Mount Adams. I know that Billy Meyer, through his long relationship with the Pleiadians and with the group that has gone around him, has established something similar to that in Switzerland. You know, there are pockets of individuals doing that different parts of the planet, and I'm very pleased to have come across Joan and seen her work here actually play a role in helping that contact happen here in on the big island of Hawaii.
Well, last year we started a series of radio shows, Joan and I did, with the intent of getting this the word out to just say yes, to open up to the possibilities that if, as we contribute to the belief system matrix and more people start to believe in the possibilities and the actual reality of ETs being here, that they will open up. They're saying to us, according to this letter that went out a year ago this October, that they're ready, but we have to collectively start saying yes. And when they start hearing a collective yes from enough people, then shall we say that the tail starts to wag the dog?
Yes, I think this is part of that consciousness influences reality. If we have enough people on the planet joining together, giving a resounding yes to this question of, well, do we want ETs to show up? And in giving that answer yes, I mean, there's some kind of visualization or manifestation that occurs where you basically get the ETs showing up as a physical 3D event. And that process, if it involves enough people around the planet, I think will produce an effect. And I think this is part of the kind of gift that John Edelman, who was the original transmitter of the message, was able to give, and I think that is part of the reason why his work is so important, and why it has come under the attention of some of the military intelligence organizations.
Yeah. So, what can you give us an update on what his situation is?
Well, there are a number of different sources reporting on what he was doing. Sources that used either remote viewing or some telepathic communication to work out exactly what he was up to, and they pointed to some projects with certain ET groups, in principle, the Lyrans and the Arcturians, where he was doing something along the lines of flight training. I do believe there is evidence that he is back, but that unfortunately he has been silenced, that there have been threats made to him, to his family, and that this has led to him actually not being able to come forward and reveal what happened, share the insights that he had, and also that there has begun a program to try to kind of discredit him.
Well, this seems to be a pattern that is reoccurring, and you're feeling ripple effects in your own life, but it's not deterred you, and congratulations for continuing ahead. You have a program that you're promoting now called the Galactic Peace Ambassador Program. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, it's based on my most recent work, which is working with the different ET groups, trying to identify who they are, identify their motivations and their activities so that people can make the right choices. And what I realise is that, well, this interaction is happening now. These different races are interacting with humanity, and people have to start making choices about which race to work with, you know, which projects to support, which projects are the ones that you should commit yourself to, and also understanding some of the kind of diplomatic issues that various ET groups have amongst themselves and in relation to humans. Mm. And so I was wanting to combine that work with the contact work that I experienced here on the Big Island with Jones Seminar and swimming with the dolphins and seeing how they are a wonderful bridge to the ET consciousness. So what I've done is put together a program that is a combination of my most recent research with the dolphin work that people like Joan do, and to combine that into a 12-13 day program where people basically are trained in the essentials of galactic diplomacy and get up to speed with what are some of the issues that they will have to make as individuals in dealing with these various ET races that are wanting to communicate. I mean, it's these different races do want to work with humans, and it's people have to make choices as to which ones they're going to open themselves up to.
Mm. And you're seeing more and more evidence of different races stepping forward. The 16, do you feel all of those are preparing to start open communications with humans at this time?
Oh, definitely, yes. They've already opened communications, and they've been doing it for quite a period of time. And the question is, well, who should we work with? The government has made their choice. They have chosen those ETs that are willing to participate in technology exchange programs and do the kind of genetic experimentation that can lead to sharing of knowledge on the human DNA and capabilities of humanity. And there are other ET groups that want to work in terms of spiritual uplift, consciousness raising. So these are choices that we all have as individuals, and I think that as people kind of like get up to speed with the different ET groups, understand what it means to establish contact with various ET races, and the kind of galactic diplomacy that's involved in this process, because there are alliances here. Certain groups work with some ETs but not others.
Right.
So as people understand this and establish connections, I think that is helpful too. As people understand the different ET races, that people who are attracted to these programs really come in touch with their starseed identity. I think many listening to your program or who would be considering attending a course like this are very much starseeds along the lines of what Brad Spiger talked about in his book, Starseeds. So I think that these starseeds, when they're presented the information, will suddenly connect with a particular ET group and say, oh, they're my guys. And once they make that connection, that ET group can come in more strongly. And so then you have this this work can proceed more. And so I think really developing a group consciousness or a program over 12-13 days along the lines of what Joan does with the ET contact seminar is really what I think is going to be a great help. And that's what I'm going to be doing, and I'll be doing it here on the Big Island.
Fabulous. That sounds great. And I really admire the work that you're doing. You're bringing a new level of, let's say, I don't want to say seriousness, because I think the dolphins have shown me that not to take ourselves too seriously in anything we do, because that restricts and makes it more rigid. They want us to be more flexible, more fluid in our interpretation of the world around us. But it's really great that you're giving us a whole body of information, that you have used all of your abilities to powers of discernment, and the fact that you are now starting to open up that region of your own being where you're getting direct contact and senses of shamanic of realities, that is bringing you to another level, and you're inviting people to join you in this great, great expansive awareness. So I really thank you for the work, because it is timely and the world is changing very rapidly. And as I said before, whether there's some magical line in the sand of 2012 when everything we know will somehow be different and changed, or maybe it's just a normal evolution of consciousness on this planet, and we're coming back into an area that we were once already, recognizing ourselves as much larger and with much greater capabilities than we could, you know, even dreamed about before. I think it's time for us to step into that power that we are. So I thank you for being here, sharing this important information, and it's great that you're going to be joining us on a more permanent basis, inviting more people such as yourself to come over and experience this, because as we join our minds together, we know that the pod mind does have power, And if we all start to resonate that yes, then things will start to change for the better. I really believe it. So thank you again.
Thank you for the interview and for this really wonderful opportunity to have a dialogue and to really have a sharing of minds. I feel as though we've done that. We've actually demonstrated this
consciousness. So I look forward to maybe coming back and having future interviews with you and see how this has developed and any more experiences that you'll be able to share, the next tier of awareness that comes into being because we've said yes, perhaps. So once again, that's exopolitics.org. Dr. Michael Sala, you can look it up on Google. You'll find a number of references. If you go to the exopolitics.org, that's exopolitics.org, you'll find information that we've been talking about, plus some of the links to the Yahoo groups and some of the future plans as they develop for the online courses and the programs for the Galactic Peace Ambassadorship. So we'll look forward to all these things. So that brings us to the end of another show here in Dolphinville. I really appreciate everyone joining us today, and I will look forward to the next time that we spend time together. There is some people I'd like to thank for this show. Thank you, Dr. Michael Sala, and thank you, Joan Ocean, for bringing him to this island. This program is being brought to you by Photon.net. Photon is an internet service provider, and through their generosity, these wave bands of information are going out. So, thank you for joining us. I will look forward to next time. This is Dolphin Us saying, be well and swim free. Until next time, see ya.